Well, good morning and happy Chinese / Lunar New Year. My name's Enoch. I'm one of the pastors here, and many of you know Pastor Ken, his entire like tribe is the flu or something. So we're praying for them, and of course many other people afflicted through disease and issues. We're glad you're here today, whether you fought traffic, weather, flu, or other things to be here. And we're beginning a new sermon series on the Book of Lamentations. So let me open our time with a word of prayer. Would you join me, please, as we dive into this text this morning? Our Father in heaven, we ask that your Spirit would enliven us and empower us to understand what this ancient funeral dirge would have to say for us today. On a day where a lot of us maybe wore a little red in honor of the New Year, which is a festive Asian sort of Chinese-minded occasion in the Chinese culture, it might be really un-Chinese to talk about death and to talk about sadness. And yet that's where we find ourselves in this text. So help us to understand what that means. Lord, wherever we're coming from, help us to see that you have a purpose for us to be here. And we pray that you would meet us now. Wherever we are in our spiritual journey, we ask this for your sake and in your name. Amen. It's become sort of our practice, at least in the English congregations, as we think of the church theme, to really begin to emphasize that around January. And the reason why we do that is because, especially for the urban campus in Chinatown, in the fall, where most people visit, it's not necessarily a time to really focus on the theme we find. People are trying to figure out what their churches are going to be. And so it doesn't seem to fit the kind of folks that are visiting church in the fall. Also, sometimes we don't figure out the theme until late into the summer. And I don't know about the other pastors, but I sure could use a little more time stewing on these thoughts. In fact, we felt so convicted about stewing on this that many of you know this is the second year in a row we're doing this theme. And so having benefited from the fall, and if not the last year and a half or two, we're now engaging this sermon series related to the theme, Seek the Peace of the City, which is our second year in a row. Now, as we think about seeking the peace of the city, there is a feature of American Christianity which tends to be what some sociologists would call triumphal. It's very optimistic. It's potentially a little bit classist or elitist, that we're going to go and we're going to change the world because we can. Now, that's in the Bible, this moving forward, marching onwards, Christian soldier, that element is there. But if you look at church history, when things were good, and whether the economy or socially more aligned with the Bible or Christianity, like the church tended to rise up and sort of stress how God is coming and how he's making his way. But when things were difficult, or when Christians were in the minority or began to feel what we'll call oppression or even persecution in some places, then the whole idea of like we're going to take over the world or bring the gospel to everybody sort of goes up and down. So we're preaching on Lamentations. Not because I think it's time to hit that cycle again, but because this is in the Bible. And we're preaching on Lamentations because if the theme is to seek the peace of the city, one of the understated ways to address how to seek the peace of the city is to actually do it this way. To seek the peace of the city by understanding what makes a city weep. That is to seek the peace of the city by learning to lament with what the city laments. To really have a heart to be broken about that. Often we don't really care about the high school sort of stressful life until we hear another case of like a high schooler taking her own life because of the pressures of being, especially in a place like Newton or Lexington. Often we don't hear about the issues of smoke cessation unless we hear these highly publicized notions of someone dying through vaping and how we know so little about vaping relative to the popularity of it, especially among younger folks. And so when we're talking about seeking the peace of the city, one of the most humble, I think God-honoring ways to do that is to say, okay, Lord, if we want to have a heart for the city, whether it's the city of Newton, the city of Boston, the city where you live, work, or play, is to say this, how do we see the brokenness through the eyes of the city? Yeah, friends, it's kind of a bummer, downer of a sermon series. Happy New Year. I did wear red. I have a little red, not like the worship team that are all wearing burgundy. But while this is a new year, I think this is important. And so Pastor Ken and I feel like the Lord has called us to really seek the peace of the city by learning to feel its brokenness, by learning and leaning into its hurt and its pain, its sinfulness and all those features, which honestly, most of us don't want to do. So if you're kind of a downer and you don't want to think about that, you've got your bright red Chinese Lunar New Year outfit on, then, please don't make me bring you down. But I believe God has given us the opportunity to really reflect on this as a church family. And if we could probably understand better what it means to really grieve with the city, what it means to lament with the city, then we might be better off at seeking the peace of the city. And so this morning, I'm going to give you all three points right now because of the way I think the passage is structured. We're going to see three things. First of all, when we think about the brokenness of the city, the first thing I'd like us to see from this text is this. Number one, God has called us to acknowledge the brokenness of the city. to acknowledge the brokenness of the city, to see it and to recognize it's there. Secondly, after we are called to acknowledge the brokenness of the city, we are to identify with the brokenness of the city. We're to actually empathize, relate, get its texture, sympathize, identify with the brokenness of the city. And after we're called to acknowledge the brokenness of the city, identify with the brokenness of the city, I believe the scripture calls us to even enter into the brokenness of the city. So acknowledge the brokenness of the city, identify with the brokenness of the city, and even enter the brokenness of the city. Yeah, and for those of you who are paying attention, there's an increasing level of engagement and intensity. Acknowledge, identify, even enter. So what can we do? How do we do this? So we're going to lean into this first of all. First point, acknowledge the brokenness of the city. Now, the Bible is written in an ancient Hebrew culture, and sometimes the Asian American background that many of you may identify with, which is a little different than sort of the Western, kind of call it majority culture that we have, you approach the Bible with different perspectives. This is one of those times where the culture of the Bible speaks something that goes totally against my Asian background. Because in my Asian background, I don't want to think or talk about pain or brokenness. We don't talk about death. You don't mention it. It's an unmentionable. You can't wear those colors on certain occasions because you just kind of, it's shameful. Whereas other cultures, you just embrace it. Now this book, the Book of Lamentations, is a historical lament, 5 poems, probably written by Jeremiah, the prophet, most people think, lamenting or bemoaning or just in great vivid detail the destruction of their beloved city of Jerusalem in 586 BC by the Babylonian Empire. Now, when they destroyed cities, Babylon had a great, they were really good at it. They didn't just go in and like take over people. They would utterly bring it to ruin. So, for example, if they would go in and find a well, like where water is coming from. And if you know some of the work that we partner with World Vision and other places around the world, digging a well is huge, life-saving. It gives those children, especially usually daughters, the chance to go to school rather than trek and hike up like 5 or 6 miles to get water and come back. So digging a well is important. But what the Babylonians would do after they conquered you is they'd find all your wells, and they wouldn't just fill them in. They would throw rocks down those wells to just completely, completely destroy that well, make it totally unfit for use. They would not just take over and destroy your crops or burn your fields. In order to totally, utterly bring you down, they would take salt and salt all your fields. So your animals could never, ever graze from that, or you couldn't possibly grow any crops in that for a whole generation. They would utterly destroy the land. And when it came to the temple of Jerusalem, the jewel of the city, which Solomon himself helped, David helped began, and Solomon finished, one of the most beautiful ancient marvels of the ancient world, they would just burn it to rubble, destroy it, take away all the precious items, just steal it, all the precious metals like gold and things, just took it all away and left it as a heap of rubble. They utterly laid it to waste, decimated it, destroyed it, and broke them emotionally, spiritually, physically, everything. This is Babylon destroying their beloved city, Jerusalem. I tried to find an equivalent today, but the destruction of the World Trade Center in New York City does not even come close. I tried to find a relation to the shooting up of children in a school doesn't come close. There's no real national symbol that just everyone identifies with. That would be so border on sacrilege because the Babylonians would enter, as we saw in the text, the temple and profane it through their pagan worship practices, utterly destroying it. So this is a huge psychologically destructive moment in all the thousands of years of the history of the Jewish people. Now, you might be Jewish or you probably know people who are Jewish, and this is historically one of the most debilitating, destructive, terrible points in the entire history. And rather than ignore it, the prophet Jeremiah chooses to acknowledge the pain. And again, for some of us, this is very socially or culturally uncomfortable. He's going to go into great vivid detail, the great pain. So let's take a look at the first couple verses just to see the prophet Jeremiah probably, or at least the writer, talking about the pain of the destruction of their precious beloved Jerusalem. Verse 1 of chapter 1. How lonely sits a city that was full of people. How like a widow has she become. She who was great among the nations, she who was a princess among the provinces, has become a slave. She weeps bitterly in the night with tears in her cheeks among all her lovers. She has none to comfort her. All her friends have dealt treacherously with her. They have become her enemies. Judah, which is another way to describe Jerusalem, the southern tribe where the city is related. Judah has gone into exile because of affliction and hard servitude. She dwells now among the nations, but finds no resting place. Her pursuers have all overtaken her in the midst of her distress. Now, again, I'm trying to paint this picture for us. Basically, the people of Israel, or the southern kingdom of Judah, were utterly destroyed. They were the most powerful, educated, wealthy people were all taken into captivity, spread throughout the Babylonian Empire in a campaign to help dilute and basically dissolve and do away with the culture. The people they left were the poor, uneducated, the miserable people left that they just thought they could just lay fallow and die in the land. And so this is an utterly painful, destructive thing. And this is almost an implicit point here, but the first point that we're called to do this, we're going to seek the peace of the city, and we're going to understand this. We need to first acknowledge the brokenness. We need to acknowledge it and see their pain, see people's pain for what it is. Now, a couple quick caveats. First of all, everything I say here in this sermon series will probably be relevant on an interpersonal level, one-to-one. But that's not what this passage is about, nor the book. This is not about the one-on-one interrelations, like, oh, you have a friend or neighbor in pain, and so you're going to enter and acknowledge their pain. Although everything we say will be applicable to that. This is actually a much more larger scale, a corporate sense. First thing. Secondly, we're going to talk about the whole chapter 1, even though I didn't have it all printed because we're public reading and just for time's sake. So we're actually going to do all of chapter 1. One of the teenagers there is very sad. He's looking down right now. And the reason is why we're doing all chapter 1 is because, as he still looks down, is because the poems, these five poems, are all written as pieces. They're called acrostic poems. Chapter 1, if you could read Hebrew, the first letter of the first verse, verse 1, begins with the equivalent of A in the Hebrew alphabet, Aleph. And then the next verse 2, that little stanza begins with the letter B in the Hebrew alphabet, and all the way so forth down. So it really is meant to be done as one big poem. To make some people feel good, just so you know, even though this thing's really long, poetry is much shorter than other genres. Okay, so if we were to do a whole chapter of another genre, we'd be still reading it. So just a quick little encouragement there. But to acknowledge the pain, he has to call us to go in there and acknowledge the pain. Now, I think we're not really good at acknowledging pain. We don't start out really good at acknowledging pain. I've learned something that as I'm old enough to be able to say, I've got friends for 5, 10, 20 years, and I have this experience now where I see them after 5, 10, 20 years. Now, some of us, if we're younger or our memory is kind of, you know, messing with us, we may not remember or have those kinds of relationships. But as you get older, you get to be able to say, oh, I haven't seen this person for 5 years or 10 years. And there is a disturbing, sad observation I would like to share with you, at least from my life, at least from my friendships. And the observation is this. If I have not seen you for a few years, and we catch up, and they ask you, how's it going? And I tell you how it is. Man, this is actually really, I'm really having a rough time. I'm unhappy at work. My marriage, my family has problems if I do that. If I basically tell them life is hard, you know what I've observed in all my friendships? Now, there's the initial lean in, or they're compassionate. Of course, they're polite. They care. But then soon after, there is a tendency to avoid you. I don't know if you've found that. If I call them, they'll, of course, call me back. But they're not eager to be around a loser or a mourner or someone in struggle. I've also been around long enough to have those same friendships. If I just tell them, hey, how's it going? I haven't seen you in a year. And I go, things are awesome. Things are, my family are great. My job, my church is great. They're just, wow, that's great to hear. And I can sense this like, oh, and before I call them back, they call me back to hang out again. Now, it could just be the shallowness of my friendships. But I think we just have an aversion to the pain and suffering of others. And if we're going to weep with the city, if we're going to weep with those who weep and mourn with those who mourn, in addition to rejoice with those who rejoice, if we're going to seek the peace of the city with all its brokenness, we must acknowledge the pain. We must acknowledge the brokenness, even though we have a tendency to avoid it. Here are some of the subtle ways we do this on an interpersonal level. And again, this is an interpersonal example. This may be very sensitive, and it may have affected you. You may have done this. You may have received this. But probably in the last few months, I've talked to so many couples in our church dealing with fertility issues. Trying to foster, trying to adopt, or trying to conceive. Now, this happens. Someone will share with their friends or their small group, we're trying to conceive a baby, we had pregnant, but we lost the child. This just happened to some really close friends in the Chinatown congregation. We lost the child. Now, it is so common and so well-intended to say to a couple, you just lost a pregnancy, to say this. And maybe you've said this. You're young. You can try again. Now, while that is technically correct and the intentions may be great, that doesn't really go over very well because they're not asking for a solution. They're sharing with you to acknowledge their pain. Or if you can't even conceive at all, people have said, again, literally just in the last couple of weeks, I've been talking to people in our church, you know, like we tell people we have fertility, doctor, we just can't conceive. She had to have that hysterectomy, remove her ovaries or uterus, with just whatever that is, those things. And you know, people, again, meaning well, say this. Well, there's always adoption. Now, if you know my theology, adoption is a grand, beautiful doctrine in the Bible. It's important, and it is a valid and beautiful thing. Salvation is described as being adopted in God's family, so there's no putting it down. At the same time, we've learned that sometimes saying that hurts. And why does it hurt? People don't understand. You're trying to encourage them. And here's why it feels like a hurt. Because they feel like you did not acknowledge the pain. Acknowledge the hurt. Acknowledge the brokenness. In fact, we've been promoting a singleness issue, a great opportunity. My whole small group, which is basically, it's me and like four older young adult single guys, and we're going like as our small group. It's a common thing. If it doesn't affect us directly, it doesn't occur to us to think about it. But the nature of acknowledging pain is to say, God, give me eyes to see things that I don't see because they don't directly affect me. They don't directly touch my life. It hurts me and pains me in a sad way because I'm struggling with this too, that if I were to go in Chinatown, I know Chinatown much better than I know Newton. I'm trying to learn Newton and also trying to learn South End because our building is in South End as well. But I'll use some examples from Chinatown. That if I were to ask my Christian friends in Chinatown campus, our church there, many of you who've been there for many years, what are the greatest needs of this neighborhood? And then I were to ask the same question to my non-Christian friends, almost all are non-Christian friends working in these social service agencies. Many of you volunteer with or serve as board members on, and ask them, what is the greatest need? One would hope that basically they would have the same answer, except maybe Christians would say, well, we see a great pressing need for them to be connected to God, to find power and hope and for redemption in Jesus. So, of course, there's that spiritual dimension that I hope people of faith would share. But after that, you'd like to think that maybe we say the same things. But that's not what I think happens, and I'm just as much an issue, a party to this as well. Because if I talk to my friends who work with the health services in Chinatown, one of the biggest issues there is smoking cessation. And I have to confess, I don't think I've ever prayed from the pulpit, God help those that are struggling with smoking cessation. Because it doesn't affect me. And if it does, I know people at church that smoke both campuses, and I know they wish I didn't know because they're kind of ashamed or they just kind of figure it's a private thing. But that's what's on the minds of a lot of people that are working in the community in that neighborhood. Just like there might be things here. To acknowledge the brokenness is to see it from their perspective and to see what, now you may not even agree with, I'm not even talking about changing your political or moral position. This is about acknowledging the brokenness of the city. Even if it doesn't directly affect or touch us. Acknowledge the brokenness, lean into the brokenness, even though I have an aversion, even though I kind of don't want to be there. And please hear me, church, I don't think I have a huge axe to grind on this. I don't think I'm angry that y'all aren't woke. I had to look up what woke means. If you don't know, that's fine. I don't say this because I have a chip on my shoulder. I say this because I believe it's in the scriptures. That if we're to seek the peace of the city, it begins by acknowledging the brokenness and the pain and the hurt. And that's before you lay blame. It's before you do root cause analysis. It's before you even provide helpful solutions. Acknowledge the brokenness of the city as a corporate whole. And I got to say one more thing. A lot of my church planning friends, and this is part of the evangelical landscape of the church in the U.S., you know, there's a sense of trying to be more engaged with their neighborhoods or cities. And so I know a lot of churches in Boston area that are doing good things. They're now engaged with the local school. And so now they're engaged with that one school, and so they're learning about that. Or they're engaged with there's a halfway homeless transitional shelter house right near them, so they're engaged with that. And that's a great step, and I'm encouraging that, and I celebrate that. But I want to keep the bar high, friends. There's a difference between interacting with one school versus interacting with the city. There's a difference between supporting and partnering with the transitional housing group right next to you versus the whole city. Now, it's good to be starting there. You got to start somewhere, local Chinese school, local school, second step, whatever is nearby, that's great, not putting those down. But that's not the city. That's a one-on-one, that's a one entity, that's an individual as opposed to this bigger heart for the city. When Jesus looked at Jerusalem and all those people without a shepherd, he saw the totality of the brokenness of that mass of people. This is what we are called to do. If we wish to seek the peace of the city, then I believe the Book of Lamentations teaches us to acknowledge the brokenness of the city. And that's not easy, and that takes God's help, and it takes humility. But that's the first point, to acknowledge the brokenness of the city. Not only are we called to acknowledge the brokenness, I believe this text, this poem, continues to actually challenge us to identify with the brokenness. Now, because we don't do Old Testament poetry enough to preaching, I want to give you a couple, two really important things to observe in the poetic nature of this genre, this text. Two literary devices, if you will. I'm going to explain them to you, and then we'll read kind of a big chunk of the passage. In order to help you identify, one device that you see the poet doing is to personify the city of Jerusalem. She's a lady in this. It's one thing to say the system is broken, has issues. It's another thing to say she is all alone, like a widow. And that's what we're going to see, that the personification of Lady Jerusalem, the metaphor, the extended metaphor that she's like a woman. Not only does the poet employ the personification to help us begin to identify, to make it a little more real, a little bit more concrete, textured. You can see, it's hard to see brokenness in the city, that big abstract thing, brokenness in, you know, in the whole city of Newton or Boston. But it's easier to think, I can imagine brokenness in a person like this woman. Not only that, but later on in the poem, in this first chapter, not only they increase the identification by also putting the poem, shifting from third person describing Lady Jerusalem to first person, what it feels like for her to be. So it's not God has broken her or judged her or, you know, sent the enemies to punish her, but God has done this to me, to my young men and my young women. God's done this upon me. So God, the poet is increasingly calling us to not just acknowledge this brokenness, but identify with it more. Let's take a look as we pick it up in verse 4. I will read quite a few verses here. Verse 4, beginning here. The roads of Zion mourn, for none come to the festival. All her, the woman, her gates are desolate, her priests groan, her virgins have been afflicted, and she herself suffers bitterly. Her foes have become the head, her enemies prosper, because the Lord has afflicted her for the multitude of her transgressions. Her children have gone away, captives before the foe. From the daughter of Zion, all her majesty is departed. Her princesses have become like deer that find no pasture. They fled without strength before the pursuer. Jerusalem remembers in the days of her affliction and wandering all the precious things that were hers from days of old, when her people fell into the hand of the foe, and there was none to help her. Her foes gloated over her. They mocked at her downfall. Jerusalem sinned grievously, therefore she became filthy. All who honored her despise her, for they have seen her nakedness. She herself groans and turns her face away. Verse 9, her uncleanness was in her skirts. She took no thought of her future, therefore her fall is terrible. She has no comforter. O Lord, behold my affliction, for the enemy has triumphed. Verse 10, the enemy has stretched out his hands over all her precious things, for she has seen the nations enter her sanctuary, those whom you forbade to enter your congregation. All her people groan as they search for bread, as they trade their treasures for food. To revive their strength, look, O Lord, and see, for I am despised. Is it nothing to you, all you pass by? Look and see if there is any sorrow like my sorrow, which is brought upon me, which the Lord inflicted on the day of his fierce anger. Verse 13, from on high he sent fire into my bones. He made it descend. He spread a net for my feet, turned me back. He has left me stunned, faint all the day long. My transgressions were bound into a yoke. By his hand they were fastened together. They were set upon my neck. He caused my strength to fail. The Lord gave me into the hands of those whom I cannot withstand. The Lord rejected all my mighty men in my midst. He summoned an assembly against me to crush my young men. The Lord has trodden as in a winepress the virgin daughter of Judah. For these things I weep. My eyes flow with tears. For a comforter is far from me, one to revive my spirit. My children are desolate, for the enemy has prevailed. Zion stretches out her hands, but there is none to comfort her. The Lord has commanded against Jacob that his neighbors should be his foes. Jerusalem has become a filthy thing among them. So we see this intensely identification. Now again, if you're not a poet-y kind of person or artsy, then I get it. But all this is to say, the poem, the writer, the author is employing all these things to help us say, more than just acknowledge the pain. Even if you weren't there, it's to identify with enough and to see it. Now, you might be thinking, because I might be thinking, well, what does that mean to identify? That sounds so good, but like, what do I actually do? How do I actually do that? I'm a high schooler. What does it mean to identify with this pain of the city that's so difficult? Or I'm a stay-at-home dad. How do I identify? Well, there's a third literary device here that is very, I think, helpful for this method, that not only helps us to kind of see it better, but to really taste it. And that third third literary tool the author employs is that of contrast. We won't get into the Hebrew technicalities, but you're going to see a number of verses where the writer says, Jerusalem was glorious like this, but now is like this. Jerusalem was beautiful like this, but is now like this. And they're contrasting the states of Jerusalem. So, for example, if you were to come back to verse 6 in the text, see this contrast. Verse 6 says, from the daughter of Zion, all her majesty has departed. She used to be majestic, but it's gone now. Her princes have become like deer that find no pasture, which again may not make you sad, but that's really sad. Animals with no place to graze. Okay, and they fled without strength before the pursuer. And if you go verse 8, Jerusalem has sinned grievously. Therefore, she became filthy. She was beautiful, but now she's filthy. All who honored her, they used to hold her in great esteem. They despise her. They have seen her broken nakedness, and she herself groans. She's so ashamed and embarrassed, she turns herself away. Take a look at this, verse 10. This is violent and violation, which almost has sexual rape connotations. The enemy has stretched out his hands over all her precious things, for she has seen the nations enter her sanctuary, those whom you forbade to enter our congregation. She was clean, and now she's unclean, entering the most violent sacrilegious act of basically profaning the temple in Jerusalem. So part of what it means to identify as you acknowledge the pain is to begin to see, okay, for whatever issue I'm thinking about, what is the contrast of what could be and versus what is? Now, what the readers did at that time is they appealed to them being able to see Jerusalem. And that's why later on in Ezra and Nehemiah, when they're talking about when they rebuild parts of the temple, the older folks are crying because they remember the glory of the temple, and this new foundation or the new wall doesn't even come close. But in the New Testament for us today, especially those of us who haven't seen ancient Jerusalem, which I presume none of us have, except in artist renditions, what we do is this. Understand how beautiful life, family, city could be in God's vision and contrast it to what we see. In a few weeks, a lot of our young people will participate in Winter Teen Conference. Minister Saul is directing it from this campus, and we'll have a bunch of teenagers in New Hampshire, high schoolers and middle schoolers. One of the features that we've had in the past, I think they're still doing it, is this sort of, you close off the camp with a campfire sharing time. I mean, it's pretty common. A lot of camps or retreats, they go around, they share, all these things like that. Now, forget the fact that these are hormonally charged teenagers, kind of probably sleep-deprived and anxious about impressing other people from other churches, all that stuff, which none of you have that problem, I'm sure. But what happens, one of the reasons why I found it so valuable to keep that is because teenagers, especially, it benefits them to hear what it's like to be in someone else's family. Not someone else's Instagram feed, with all its impressive filters, not someone else's Snapchat where it's just, or TikTok just because it's a funny thing, but actually what it's like to hear the brokenness of a teenager share about her parents. And I distinctly remember a kid from Newton campus coming home and reporting to us, because of the campfire sharing at Summer Teen Conference, they said, I did not know how messed up some families can be. Especially when they're friends with that kid. They know their uncle and auntie. They know their parents. Their parents are supposedly friends of that kid's family. And the pain and the brokenness, the idea of seeing that is so eye-opening. And this happens today in the world of development and relief. World Vision, one of our partners, or Compassion, or our missionaries, the big thing they want you to do on a short-term mission is to go and see. Obviously, a 1 week of missions is not going to really probably make a big impact compared to those missionaries that devote more time there. That's a whole different discussion about the value of short-term missions. But one of them, I think, has to be admitted is this. To go and see the spiritual and other types of impoverishment opens our eyes. Without seeing the contrast, we become comfortable and complacent. Or without seeing the contrast, we become self-righteous. Well, they're in that problem because they've made their own problem. They've made the mistakes. So it's all about seeing the contrast to what God could envision as beautiful, whole, healthy, and just, and righteous, and morally pure with what we struggle with here in this life. Let me start, again, we started individually with church. The idea of like kids seeing what other kids are like, the idea of going to other churches. It's what I also do on a church level. When I go get to speak at places, I often ask them, if they invite me, can I bring like a partner, like my spouse? Like, of course you can bring your spouse. Yeah. I said, well, usually Karen doesn't want to go. Can I bring a colleague from church? And because they said yes, they have to let me bring. So I brought like Ryan, Kirk, Calvin, Steve, lots of places. And this is the first time in 2 months I'm going to bring Lorraine. There's obviously logistical challenge of traveling long distances with a woman. But this is a church camp where the retreat is to the whole congregation, and their children's minister will be there. So I'm looking forward for Lorraine having quality time with their children's minister, because normally if I speak at a college event, there are no children. So the idea of seeing that and actually understanding that helps us appreciate what we have here. We've had the opportunity to partner with a lot of Chinese heritage churches in other places around the world, like Scandinavia. And the main thing that just gets me is, I've said this to Saul when he got here, I've said this to TIB counselors, our youth staff on Sunday mornings at times, after I've acknowledged the pain of needing more counselors, I'm looking right at Phil. But at some point, we have to say this. There are more youth staff here than the combined volunteers of four other churches I know in New England. There are more people on pastoral paid staff here than they're all volunteers in so many other immigrant churches around up and down the East Coast. There are so many youth counselors in Chinatown that if you add up all the youth workers in the Chinatown campus, they're bigger than the average youth group in New England among immigrant churches. So let's just kind of see the contrast of what it can be like. I'm constantly telling my children, do you understand? So I come home from counseling, and I do a lot of counseling. I have the privilege to meet with a lot of people that share me their pain. And once in a while, I'll just kind of sit with my kids, and I'll batch them. I don't tell who I'm talking about, but I'll say, boys, some people in our church, they really have a hard time because they're afraid of losing their home because they can't afford to stay in their home. They go, yeah? Well, first of all, they don't go, oh, yeah. I said, did you hear me? Uh-huh. No, did you hear me? Yeah, I hear you, Baba. Or I'll tell them the kinds of problems. Or we'll do a genogram, which is like a family tree with some other issues about violence or abuse. And I literally did a genogram of my son, Kian. And I said, look, everyone's happy. Everyone has good relations. And I anonymized another genogram where they show this person's relationship to the sexual abuse they had from that parent and that uncle and the brokenness against that sibling and just the multiple half-siblings. So your genogram is clean and green and just so happy. But look at what this is a normal person in the youth group has. This is like their life. Just trying to help my kids understand, because in order to identify with the brokenness, God says, I want you to see the great contrast that could be in social wellness, in impoverishment, in health, in spiritual vitality, in family well-being, it's all those things. To identify with someone's pain is to acknowledge a pain that you might not necessarily have, and then as you think about that, begin to say, okay, what does it look like differently in other cities? In other families, in other places. To move it to the city level, just this is going to be a kind of a low-key example. I remember talking to a friend who works in the city in public works, streets, roads, and tunnels. And something struck me that I'd never thought of before. And he's like, I'm so embarrassed for the city of Boston, especially around Olympics and tourism time because we're comparing other cities. I go, why? And he said this to me, Enoch, our tunnels in Boston, they are ugly. I mean, I grew up in L.A., so we don't have tunnels. We just have angels and sunshine above us. So I start paying attention, driving through. Yeah, I mean, I'm not putting down public works. It is filthy in those tunnels. Have you driven through the nice tunnels in this country? Like Chicago's some really nice tunnels. It's beautiful. They're proud of that. And these city workers, these MBTA workers, they're just like really discouraged at the state of how they keep our. So I complain about potholes and sidewalk, but that's their job. I only complain about sidewalk because it's in my way. But someone is constantly trying to figure out how to make it safe and well. Until you realize you have little kids, then that little neighbor that didn't shovel their snow means no stroller can get through. Until you have friends who have walkers and wheelchairs, you realize that's not enough for an elderly person to get by or someone who can't walk. This is totally unhelpful. Until you have Wuhan virus and understand that people have compromised immune systems, it's so easy to not really think about communion standards and do they really wash their hands, and pass the peace of Christ, pass the germs of humanity, whatever, all that stuff. Are we really thinking about on a big scale corporate level? And this is what God is calling us, the church. Not just because it affects you and me right now, but because it's in His Word, because it's part of what it means to live for Christ. It's what it means to seek the peace of the city. And I remember talking to one of our pastors years ago, when we bought Newton Campus, this is a fear. I'd only been in church a few years at this church, and this is something expressed by multiple pastors at the time. Enoch, you're from California, right? Yeah. You had suburban church? Yeah. How do you do suburban church ministry? I go, what do you mean? Well, in Chinatown, you offer English classes, you help broken families, but suburbs, they don't need anything. And I can see that. It's hard. You don't grow through ESL classes or ELL classes. You don't grow through like having free clinics for the low-income youth. Yeah. But here's the thing. I remember one of the three times in my life I said something useful. I said, there's a lot of brokenness in the suburb. You just have to learn to see it. It's there. I think it's more broken because it's better hidden behind nice homes, behind good school districts. It's there. And God is calling us, each camp, as a church to care, but also in each campus, to see the brokenness, to acknowledge it, and then to identify with it. And they do that. Now, again, for some of us, the first thing is just acknowledge the pain and brokenness that we don't really see. God, open my eyes to see things that I never thought about. There's a huge thing a couple weeks ago, in the last few weeks, has been rent control. There's a huge rally about rent control. Almost no one I know from a middle-class church knew about it going on at the State House. All my friends, whether they're Christian or not, lower income in subsidized housing, knew about it. It was a big deal. How do we make that a part of what we care about? And again, I'm not even suggesting you change your political views or change your moral positions, although I think the Bible should inform that, or actually we should follow what the Bible says. First step, acknowledge the brokenness. Second step, just as we do that, help us to identify with the brokenness. Which leads us to our third step. I mean, not that this is a single step at a time. It's a journey. You've never acknowledged all the brokenness in yourself or in your city, but it's kind of a mindset. So see how they're acknowledging the brokenness after we talk about identifying with it, seeing the contrast, trying to see how it could be so good or so difficult, which makes us have some empathy. Thirdly, I think this passage talks about entering the brokenness. And this is really uncomfortable. But it's sort of the last part of the verses, and to kind of help us to see this in the final verses, verses 18 to the end, let me explain. Whenever we see brokenness, there's three human responses. And I think all of them have some validity, but I think we tend to major on one. So just hear me out before we read this passage. So if you see someone having a problem in their life, or see a neighborhood having a problem with some decision they made, here's three ways we typically do it with people or systems. Number one, it's your fault, so you got to clean up your mess. Or put it this way, it's my fault, so this is very Chinese. It's my fault, so I can't complain. Like, I chose this restaurant, my fault, I'm not going to complain. I picked this airline flight, that's my fault, I'm not going to complain. I made my bed, I'm going to sleep in it. And if it's my fault, I just kind of suck it up. And especially if you have an Asian background, I don't really complain about it because I'm not trying to make other people's lives worse. I'm not trying to be the center of attention. I'm just going to just own my responsibility and suffer, because in Chinese spirituality, silent suffering is a virtue. And there's a place for silent suffering, but Lamentations is not silent. So silent suffering, just my fault, just suck it up. The other versions would be this. You know, the brokenness we see, that's God's fault. That's other people's faults. It's because that racial group, or that class group, or that political group, or that religious group, that group did this, and so they're the ones who have problems. It's their fault, they're messed up. So if it's my fault, I shut up, I suck it up, and I just deal with it. If it's their fault, I'm going to complain and rail against it because of the power asymmetry, or because of, you know, the systemic injustices, or because of whatever it is, the historic wealth inequality, whatever the language might be in our studies, that's the other tendency. Blame them. If it's their fault, they got to deal with it. And then lastly, to people of faith, you have an option if you're a person of faith. Because not only in people of faith can you blame yourself or blame other people, people of faith can blame God. Atheists don't get to blame God. Christians can blame God, and they do. And if it's God's fault that I'm dealing with this, then, I don't know, you're impotent, God, you can't fix it, then what's the point? Or you see but you don't care, then what's the point? Or you just don't, I don't know, like maybe you don't know, you're not as great as I thought you were. And either way, if you think it's God's fault, there's really no point to keep the conversation going. Now, in each of those ways entering the pain, you tend to enter one way, like it's my fault, I'll just suck it up. Other people's fault, blame them. God's fault, just forget it. Give it up, all hope. In this final verses of this chapter, you see the writer employ all three. They acknowledge the blame, they point to themselves, they point to others, and they point to God. But they do not limit it to those three. Let's take a look at this. Chapter 1, verse 18. Now that we've got that prepped, we can now read this passage. Verse 18 says, "The Lord is in the right, for I have rebelled against his word. But hear, O you peoples, and see my suffering. My young women and my young men have gone into captivity. I called to my lovers and they deceived me. My priests and elders perished in the city while they sought food to revive their strength. Look, O Lord, for I'm in distress. My stomach churns. My heart is wrung within me because I have been very rebellious. In the street, the sword bereaves. In the house, it is like death. They heard my mourning, my groaning, yet there is no one to comfort me. My enemies have heard of my trouble, and they're glad, they're happy for it, that you have done it. You have brought the day you have announced. Now let them be as I am. Let all the evil doing come before you and deal with them as you have dealt with me because of all my transgressions. For my groans are many, and my heart is faint. So let me just show you the unusual perspective that this chapter concludes with. The one hand, it says, it's my fault. But contrary to what I was raised, it's my fault, but their view of God still says, God, but I know it's my fault, but please help me. I cry out for mercy. Even though I know it's my fault, I still have the audacity to ask you for help. I have the gall. That's where shame is, right? If I've taken money that my parents have given me and I squandered it, I'm too embarrassed. I'm too ashamed to go back to them. But this person says, it's my fault, but they cling and cry out to God. This person also blames other people. This person says, you know, my enemies have forsaken me, and they laugh at me. They're glad that I've gone through this trouble. But instead of saying, God, destroy them, this person appeals to say, God, because you are just, and because you are a just God that punished me for my wickedness, then I appeal to you for your justice, that you will again serve justice, and you will eventually, either here on this earth or in the afterlife, appease justice and make them pay for their wickedness as well. So it's not it's their fault, punish them. It's a, God, it's their fault, just like me. And the same way I can cry out to mercy for you, I say, God, vindicate your justice and punish them, not because I'm angry at them, but because you are a just God. And actually, you have to hear this whole next few sentences, because this is very nuanced, and you could get bad theology if you don't pay full attention right now. Lamentations chapter 1 portrays God as the enemy of Israel. Now, that's a really charged statement if you know theology. In this chapter, I believe, it portrays God as an enemy of Israel. Not that it's against Israel, not that God is unfaithful to his covenant, but in this way, God has brought this upon Israel. God has brought this upon his people. So this person has an understanding to say, okay, God, you've done this to me. This is your doing, and yet you're just, and you're right. It's my fault, but I cry out to you for mercy. It's other people's faults, but I don't need to condemn them. I just appeal to you for justice. And God, you've done this to me. But you now hear this. But because, God, you are just and you keep your promises and you're good, even though you've done this to me, even though you've used wicked people to do this to me, even though it's my fault, I still ask you for mercy. So how do you enter the brokenness? You can only enter the brokenness and lean into it when you understand that God keeps his promises. That's the only way you can do this. To put another way, most of us enter brokenness with two mindsets. Either it's I can fix it or it's hopeless. If I enter brokenness with I can fix it, then I feel the responsibility and I go in and it's impossible to be humble. If you're going to do short-term missions in a country that has less technological developments, less systems of justice or economy, you go there, it's just too easy to come in the condescending sort of American, we're Americans, we know how to fix things. We've seen that at all levels of government. But if we think it's our responsibility and we go in there, we might feel hopeless. So here's the fundamental difference. You can only enter the pain and enter the brokenness when you are absolutely convinced you can't bring the solution. It has to be God. Because if I think it's on me, I'm gonna kind of let you know. You need help from me? Let me help you. You need help from the church of Jesus? Let us show you how it's really done. You can't help but be arrogant. But if you come in thinking it's on you and it's too big a task, it's too much to look at the pain. It's just too hopeless. People that are haughty or hopeless have the same problem. They think they are the solution. If you have detected in your heart an aversion to entering brokenness, it could be because deep down you are trying to fix it yourself. Otherwise, why would you get proud when it goes well if you're not trying to fix it for yourself? Otherwise, why would you despair and not even enter the pain? The only reason God gives me the strength to sit through hours of counseling, and in the last few months there's been quite a bit of counseling, I don't know if it's winter or sad or whatever it is because I have to ask God every moment that there's no way I can fix this. It's not on me. I mean, I can make it worse, and I hope that I can give them helpful biblical insight, practically, but I'm absolutely convinced I can't fix it. But because I can't fix it, because it's not on me, I can enter into the pain. Because I can't fix it, but I believe God has this ability and power, I can run with you as long as your pain allows me to be with you. I'm not afraid of it. I may not find it distasteful, but I can endure it. The only way we can enter the brokenness of a whole city, let alone a family or a couple or a person, is when the Church of Christ understands the appeal to address the brokenness is completely by God. Only the Christian gospel does that, because only in the Christian gospel did God himself enter the brokenness of humanity. And by that brokenness, walk with humanity, sleep with humanity, feel all the temptations, but never broke down, never sinned. That's the Christian unique gospel perspective on brokenness. Every other system is about looking down on the brokenness or feeling hopeless in the face of brokenness. But only the gospel, only Jesus enters the brokenness. And as he enters the brokenness, gives us hope for our brokenness and invites his church to walk with him. So on a personal level, if you feel like the city is just, oh my gosh, it's overwhelming. My life is a mess. And if you are losing hope, it's probably because deep down you are putting some of the hope on yourself. Becoming a Christian is simply saying, I don't have the hope. I can't do it. But becoming a Christian also means that God can. And because he can do it, it doesn't make me cocky. It makes me humble. It makes me be willing to look at the city, look at the brokenness. So as we think about seeking the peace of the city, as we in our English congregations focus on Lamentations, may God teach us how to weep with the city, to not just rejoice with those who rejoice, but to mourn with those who mourn, to weep with those who weep. That God may help us to acknowledge the brokenness of the city, including the brokenness that we bring about ourselves by what the Bible calls our sin. But before we blame them or do root cause analysis or give helpful advice, to acknowledge the brokenness, to ask God by his mercy to help us identify with the brokenness. And identify does not mean agree with their perspectives every time, but see the contrast of what could be and what is. And then with Christ as our helper and our strength, to enter that brokenness. Because it's not up to us. It's all by him. Let's pray together.